Hello, listeners. Today, we are going to have a very special roundtable tea party. Joining us today is none other than Jordan Heath, the Mad Hatter, because the dude never takes his hats off even indoors. And my other guest, Todd Purse, the White Rabbit, because he's always in a hurry to talk over myself and Jordan. And with us in spirit is Christina, the Crescent Hair. She could not join in when we were recording, but I am using her artwork as the episode art. Go support her. Links in my episode description, Instagram at The Crescent Hair. But yeah, today, myself, Jordan, and Todd will be discussing a very cute little fuzzy horny bunny, the jackalope that we all know and love. But do we really know anything about it? Other than that it's cute, and that people love displaying dead animal remains in bars. But to be honest, guys, we only start off with the jackalope, and as is the nature of its antlers, it just branches and branches off and entangles and twines into so many different directions. The jackalope is a staple of American folklore, but also of American history, colonialism, and the capitalization of modern mythology. It is also heavily a trickster entity that conveys the duality of life and death, of cute and terrifying, of the feminine and the masculine, and of reality and imagination. So follow us into this rabbit hole where we will definitely be using a lot of shitty puns to discuss the jackalope the way nobody ever expected.
Yappy dog in the background.
Is it a yappy dog or is it a jackalope?
Could be either.
Is that your giant dog making that noise?
No.
Oh, that's a different dog?
That's the corgi.
Okay, I was going to say, that's a wild noise for a giant dog. What kind of puppy is that?
That's a wolfhound. Irish wolfhound.
Yeah. So we're recording now, and right off the bat, everybody heard, we're talking about the jackalope today.
Yeah.
Kind of a roundtable discussion, though Christina could not make it with us today. So it is only me, Jordan from Campfire, Tales of the Strange and Unsettling. Hello, Jordan.
Hello. I'm excited to be here.
Todd Purse from Create Magic, among other things.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Among so many other things.
Just a few.
Oh, man. So I already did an episode with two guests at once. It was not very hard to edit it, so I hope this will be pretty easy.
Yeah, good luck.
Though we have a corgi as well guesting.
Yeah.
So what I intended with this episode is there are millions of shows out there with all the information you can possibly imagine about the jackalope. And earlier this year, there was a book published on the jackalope. I now listen to a podcast appearance from the author. I did a jackalope episode for my old podcast before this book existed, and everything he was talking about relating to his book is like the same thing I researched up. So I'm like, wow, there's not much info on the jackalope then. So if you want depth to this creature that everybody knows, but not many people know much about, I think the depth comes from the people who are attracted to the jackalope and their maybe reasoning why. So my idea with this discussion is essentially why we love the jackalope and what it means to us.
Sure.
I love it.
So if we can start off, Jordan, why do you love the jackalope so much?
I think the appeal of the jackalope for me is the world of cryptids and folklore creatures can be very dark. It can be very sort of spooky. You know, we just finished October and everyone's episodes were all tinged with, you know, spookiness and darkness, and aside from yours. But the jackalope has always felt sort of like a breath of fresh air in that field, because it's like there's so many elements to it that are sort of silly and fun. And it's also something that's very obviously a hoaxed creature.
Yes.
But no one cares. It's fine. It doesn't offend anyone. No one's upset that it was a hoax. It's like a blind spot for those people who think hoaxes are, you know, this terrible scourge on cryptozoology. They don't seem to notice. So.
And also it's a taxidermy hoax that we kind of revived into a living creature via folklore, because it did originally start as a taxidermy, and a very, very interesting, like the origin of the jackalope, how it came into public consciousness is as a dead thing. And then we made it alive via storytelling.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's like a series of incongruities, right? Like, is it a deer? Is it a rabbit? Is it silly or is it scary? Is it alive? Is it dead? Is it real? Is it not? Pick which one interests you the most, and you can go down any of those rabbit holes, pun intended. And there are also lots of synchronicities in the history of the jackalope. Like,
exactly.
One that blows my mind is, okay, so it was originally, it was what, 1932,
the Herrick brothers in Douglas, Wyoming. And one of the brothers is named Douglas in Douglas, Wyoming.
Amazing.
Also happening in 1932, the guy who, I forget his name.
Richard E. Shope, if you're maybe talking about him, the virologist.
Yes. That's the same year he starts his research on the papillomavirus that causes the growths on rabbits that a lot of people think inspired the jackalope to begin with.
And it did not inspire the jackalope. It actually inspired vague myths and legends, and not just in America, but all over the world.
Yeah.
In early European bestiaries, you had the Lepus cornutus, which was like a horned hare.
Right.
There's the Almiraj in Arabic folklore, which is a unicorn jackrabbit. In Germany, you have the Rasselbach, you have the Wolpertinger. In Sweden, the Squadder. So all these, you know, horned rabbits in various different cultures. Yeah. But in America, how the jackalope came to be is not via this very biological phenomenon. But as I recall, the Herrick brothers, one day they were hunting rabbits and they had a lot of rabbit corpses. They came back home and they just chucked them into the corner somewhere. And then one rabbit just ended up near a pair of deer antlers, and they looked at that rabbit and saw, like, it's like the deer antlers were protruding out of its head, and they were like, wow, we should mount this and sell it.
Yeah, just like he looks over this corner of animal corpses and sees this like shining glorious thing. He's like, oh, it lined up perfectly, let's do it. There's also a really cool story from Buddhism about a horned rabbit. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
I am familiar, but I did not look into it.
So basically the whole point of it is, like, the sort of enlightened one is speaking with students, and he's like, so you think the horned rabbit is real? That's proof that you don't understand anything about reality or life or any of that. And then he comes back later and he's like, well, the horned rabbit is real in your mind now, and tries to explain that. And then it ends up, he's like, so you don't think the horned rabbit is real? That's proof that you don't understand anything about life or the world or consciousness. It, like, basically it conveys the point that it's real and not real simultaneously. And you have to understand that you can hold those two truths.
Yes, that conveys the polarity that you said is what attracts you to the jackalope. I know the story of the Huichol people from Mesoamerica. They have a myth that rabbits are the ones who grow horns and give them to deer, and that's how deers get their antlers.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
So, Todd, can you give us your reasoning why you love the jackalope?
So I just learned more about the jackalope in the last 5-10 minutes there of you all talking about it than I knew going into this, for sure. But I do love the imagery associated with the jackalope. It's one of those ones I was never super inspired to look into a whole bunch, but I love the more cute side of the paranormal, or the more adorable side of things. And I think the jackalope, just from looking at like the Google image page, which was all the research I did for this, you can see like almost all of them are just cute ass bunnies with antlers, which is really cool, because most times you put antlers on something, it's a lot more like kind of evil looking, or like it's meant to make it look more.
Yeah, like the modern interpretation of the Wendigo, for example.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, it's usually, even I guess from like a biological standpoint, they're like, you know, signs of fighting and like, you know, competition or whatever you want to say as far as mating. But it's really awesome to just see them on these little baby like bunny rabbits that are popping out of nowhere. And I mean, one of the things that I love about this type of stuff is how it's reinterpreted by artists and creatives. And I think this is one of the more fun reinterpretations. It makes me think of, I think it was Stephanie Quick's part of the Strange Semantics episode where she talks about just like, you know, paranormal or the para weird being cuter and more adorable than a lot of people. And I think this falls right in line with that.
And she also talked about winged cats. which,
yes,
another chimera,
or something that was inspired by just a medical condition that cats can have. So that ties into the jackalope then.
Didn't even know that. That's amazing.
Also, if you're talking about artist interpretations, the one thing that's unique about the jackalope is that you can only in this case be seeing an artist interpretation of an artist interpretation.
It's true.
Because the original jackalope is an artist creation, right?
Absolutely. No, right. Yeah. Taxidermy is like, it's almost like a different type of art than you get to. I like to think about the mediums in this stuff and like what other folktale has like taxidermy at the center of it. There's like a lot of stuff that's been inspired by paintings or like different kind of stories told throughout the generations. But that's a special kind of magic to start with.
I can think of maybe the Fiji mermaid, right?
Yes.
And that's it.
Yes.
The only
big thing is Fiji mermaid.
And way darker, right?
Yes, much darker.
And way more racist as well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Also very problematic.
I mean, even the whole shrunken heads industry of that time, that's a whole topic that I want to cover for an episode, but it requires so much research.
Yeah.
But Todd, as you are an artist, I wanted to ask you, like, have you ever thought about rogue taxidermy and its artistic implications? Like, how do you perceive that form of art?
It's one of those things that, like, baffles me and amazes me. I have a few friends that are like, I guess they dabble in some taxidermy. Like I know a couple people that do it professionally, and it's like anything else where when done right, it's almost like more primal and like more powerful because of that, if that makes sense. And something that I think about a lot is culture's relationship to death and people that are dealing with, you know, death and creation at the same time, which are two things that are heavily related, whether it's like birth and death or just like, you know, killing ideas to create new ones. That's got to lead to a lot of things that it's above my pay grade, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. I like how you say that it evokes primal artistry, because, you know, like from anthropological studies, that back then cave people created sculptures or needles or whatever from bones.
Yeah.
So you were using what you have at your disposal, and what you have is not much. You have weapons to hunt down something so you can eat it, and then you have a pile of bones after that.
Yeah.
Then, well, might as well use it for artistic and aesthetic purposes.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, because the alternative at that time was literally to waste food to create art, which is a thing that people who were like scrounging for every bit of their, you know, sustenance, they were still taking some of their food to the side to create mediums for art.
Okay, but that then ties into mine and Todd's idea of imaginal offerings.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're sacrificing their food to create for them.
Yeah, the fairy tithe, giving 10% of your harvest to the fae.
Yep.
Yeah. I never thought about it through that aspect, but yeah, all the traditional dyes and everything were made of flowers or berries or things that have a lot of a higher value as far as sustenance goes than just making shit with it. So
So at some point, someone was like, creating this art is more important than going to bed with a full stomach tonight.
Yeah, that's special. For sure.
Now I'm thinking like taxidermy essentially is a form like hunters like to do taxidermy.
Yeah.
You know how hunters like to mount heads of animals on their walls and whatnot. Sure. I've always thought that's such a morbid, fucked up thing, but it's like you are providing an offering back to nature in the form of artistry. Like you kill a deer and then you give back 10% of the deer, like just the head, in the form of art as an imaginal offering back.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That is. I think all of that comes with intent, though. I think it can be done either way. Like I think it's like any other thing where like you can definitely hang the head of dead animal on the walls as a jerk or do it in a way that is giving back. And like, I think your intention behind that probably affects the offering in some way or another. Most of the people that I was referring to that do it more scavenger style. Like it's all like mouse heads or like skulls and skeletons in which they find in the woods. And then I'd call it more almost like miniature or diorama making. Like it's usually like, you know, in a very lush scenery, or they'll repurpose it into some sort of jewelry.
Okay. But as you say, repurposing, they are not killing anything to create the art. They are scavenging what is already out there.
Totally.
So you're making an offering from what nature is already providing you. It's kind of, it's leftovers. Nature provides you its leftovers so you can create something out of that.
It makes me think, there's a dude that I had on, they're one of my favorite artists. Their name is Robin Banks. And what Robin's idea as far as like the afterlife or what happens to us when we pass away was essentially that we, like, you know, the feeling that you get when you're laying in the grass or doing something very mundane in nature and you're just like inspired out of nowhere, that like kind of divine hits you. Their idea is that when we die, we kind of go back into it and are reincarnated via imagination. And that feeling of inspiration is little souls popping into you via the grass blades or things like that. And it reminds me of that, like on a different level, which is something I really like.
Okay, so there is another undertone to the jackalope that people may be more critical of. Jordan, I can't remember the name of that Indiana University professor who does studies on proto festivals.
Yeah, you always bring him up and I forget his name.
Yeah,
also.
Yeah. you know him from the Beast of Churubusco stuff, but yeah. He also did his studies on Douglas, Wyoming, because they have an annual Jackalope Day and the whole town's economy is dependent on the jackalope. Like, they issue jackalope hunting licenses. They sell jackalope milk.
Wow.
Yeah, so Douglas, Wyoming has kind of brought this myth to the forefront for economic reasons. And I have read a bit about what he says about the jackalope in Douglas, Wyoming. I don't know if it's kind of negative and cocky the way he writes about it, or if it's just the academic jargon, you know? When you write something academically, it comes off as very
cool and detached. And
Yeah. So I can see Douglas, Wyoming cashing in on the legend and it being in their best interest for the legend to bloom and spread because their economy depends on it. But still, unlike other towns who have a legend that they're cashing in on and have proto festivals and whatnot, Douglas, Wyoming is doing it very tongue-in-cheek. They're not making this out to be like a real thing, you know? They're making it very, very obvious that even they themselves take the jackalope as a joke.
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing that sets them apart is they're just openly proud of this weird bit of history from their town and the effect that it's had on the world, you know, like that's what the festival is about. It's not about, you know, pretending that this thing was real. It's about, we created this sociological phenomenon. We're responsible for it. And now it's everywhere. And we're proud of that. So we want to celebrate it.
And I don't see anything bad in that. I don't know if it's just the academic jargon being used of like, oh, these people are using this for economic purposes and, you know, appropriation, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. But at least they're being honest with it, you know, because some other towns actually take this shit way too seriously. And then you can say, oh, if they're having an economic benefit, they're having it from fooling people into believing something that's not real.
Sure.
Instead of providing the myth as a form of entertainment, pastime, a more tongue-in-cheek thing.
Yeah. And I think his writing comes across that way sometimes, like you said, because it's highly academic and it's kind of detached. But when you hear him speak about these things, like he's fully supportive of proto festivals. He loves that they exist. I mean, he's basically devoted a big chunk of his career to examining them.
Yes.
So like, he is a fan of them.
And that's the unfortunate part of when you are an academic, you need to structure everything in the, you know, scientific academic lingo. And a lot of these artistic expressions and emotions are lost in that. Like tomorrow I am going to interview the writer of the Popobawa book. I'm also going to have the hosts of Monster Talk on my show, who actually had, you know, that guy who's working on proto festivals. And we're going to talk about why it's important to study monsters from a skeptical perspective and academic one. So I'm looking forward to learn more about that. And maybe I can go into these topics as well. Like, what is lost when you translate folklore into a more academic form?
Yeah, I think quite a bit is lost. Unfortunately, the guy wants to keep getting his papers published, so he has to kind of toe the line.
Yeah.
And I think that like academic rigor does kind of strip away a lot of the emotion, a lot of the personal side of what people are, you know, experiencing while researching these topics. Unfortunately, I think that's a massive part of these topics.
Yeah. And I like how the jackalope actually conveys this duality? Like, should you be taking it seriously or should you be laughing at its face? Is it, as you said, like cute and sweet, or is it a vicious animal that will murder you?
Yeah.
Per the folklore, it is very aggressive, known as the warrior rabbit.
Yeah, so don't try to milk it.
It conveys this polarity and duality, but also like in a very black and white sort of way. There's no gray area with the jackalope.
Yeah.
Was the cuteness embedded from the beginning? Like oh, yeah. Was there a cute element to this the whole time?
The very first one that hung on the wall of the bar for like 40 some years.
Yes.
It was adorable.
and then somebody stole it.
Yeah. Yep. In classic Wild West fashion, someone just pulled
you
it
know,
down.
You know what's interesting? The guy who owned that hotel where the first jackalope was mounted, his name was, I think, Roy Ball. And yeah. There is this piece of folklore that says that the jackalope was first trapped in 18 something. I have the jackalope hunting license here with me. man, this, like, it has a whole wall of text, but it is in tiny letters. So, yeah. It says the first recorded sighting of a jackalope was by Roy Ball, an occasionally sober trapper who staggered into the Wyoming territory around 1829. The thing is, you can't take this seriously because Roy Ball was the owner of that hotel in 1932.
Yeah.
So he was nowhere near being alive like a century earlier.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's the thing, is they put everything in it like that. It's all so openly a joke. You know what I mean? Yeah.
And I find it fascinating, like when you go on websites or blogs or whatnot, they will specifically say, oh, yeah, the jackalope was reported by some Roy Ball dude in the 1800s. And it's obvious per the hunting license that it's just a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that affects the outcome of the hoaxes? Like going into it as a joke versus like, you know, some of the things where people try to present it as real. Like, what do you think that changes as far as the outcome or the mythology of all this stuff?
I think that it is very important that this thing starts out as a joke and a tongue-in-cheek thing. And then everybody applies their own interpretation to it, because if it's a joke from the get-go, people can interpret it in various different ways and it will incorporate itself into their personal folklores.
Yeah, it becomes fodder for new imaginal offerings, right? From each individual. Yeah.
But if you, from the get-go, try to portray something as totally real, then only the people who think it's totally real will be attracted to it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Has anyone tried to portray something totally real that's just this damn cute? Like, everything I think of is like some horrible big monster or something that's been hoaxed. Like, someone should try and do, like, combine the two.
I'm thinking now, man, and I mean, everybody loves the squonk, but the squonk is also a fearsome critter, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody knows it's not a real thing.
Yeah, that's another one that I don't know nearly enough about except for its adorableness.
I find it, okay, so a lot of people categorize the jackalope as a fearsome critter, but the thing is, fearsome critters spawned from lumberjack tall tales, and like not in the early 1900s, but much earlier.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And jackalope is much more a modern interpretation of it, but also it did not spawn from lumberjack tall tales, but actually as a marketing stunt.
Yeah.
Kind of like the oh man, in Wisconsin, the hodag.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
That makes sense.
So the fearsome critter aspect in the folklore is something that has been tacked on retroactively. It's not that the monster spawned from tall tales, but rather you manufacture a monster and then you manufacture tall tales retroactively that, oh, it was seen before.
Yeah.
We made it.
Totally.
I think of the jackalope as like almost an homage to the tall tales of the West from the 19th century, you know, because that was such a tradition.
But isn't it interesting that it was not intentionally made as an homage? Its main intention was, we want to sell this thing.
Yeah.
But it's like we are unintentionally conveying homages, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole idea that like nothing's original, right? Everything that our minds put together is just an amalgam of things we've absorbed over time, right?
Yeah.
So, but I think it is important to to think about the fact that these tall tales were such a huge part of Western U.S. culture in the 19th century. It was like, it was a huge, I mean, it was a super important part. It definitely draws from that same feeling, right? That like people coming in, travelers, tourists, whatever, they come in and it gives them this feeling of like, we know this and you don't, right? We know about this thing that you don't know about. So sit down, let us tell you about it. Because the people who settled the West, there was a really big thing where people on the East Coast sort of looked down on the people who were settling the West. Like they were like country bumpkins.
How ironic is that? Because the people in the East actually were people who were fleeing the homeland of you know, the UK.
Right.
And now these other people are fleeing the Eastern seaboard going West. And it's the same thing. Like you're treating them now just as your homeland people have been treating you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, like that's where these tall tales came from.
Jordan, question historically, were the people heading out west, were they the extremes of the culture? Like, you know, the people that came here were the extremes of the religious culture from the homeland, right? Were the extremes of those people the ones forging west to the uncharted territory?
The obvious, like, example of that, the Mormons who settled Utah.
Yep. That's true. That makes so much sense. So is that common throughout all of it?
I mean, they weren't necessarily all religious extremes, but they were definitely the like, it was seen as like, you have to be crazy. Like you have to be fucking nuts if you're going to go west. Like
makes sense. It,
they had this view of the unsettled country as like going to Mordor. Like it was like terrifying to go out there. And the people who stayed east, there was a sentiment that like, oh, we'll let the crazy people go out there and tame the wild. And then we'll go take a look at it. You know?
Huh. Okay. Was there an element of, oh, these people are crazy because they will be interacting with the natives?
Yep, that too. Yeah, that and just the wild terrain, you know, like, I mean, if you read some of the stories of people who settled the West, like dragging these, you know, 900-pound wagons through completely unsettled mountainside, it was arduous journeys.
It was Mordor.
Oh, we all know the example of the Oregon Trail.
Yeah. Yep. And the Donner Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you might as well be going into the mouth of hell at that point. I mean, who the hell knows? Like the unknown alone. It's that's super interesting. I mean, how? Yeah. Sorry. I just lost my train of thought. I
want to ask, like, is that maybe why, let's say, the Pacific Northwest is much more politically liberal because they originate from people who intentionally went into the unknown?
Yeah. I mean, that could definitely be argued, right? Hmm.
Yeah,
I'm becoming a political podcast. That's why I wanted this type of episode for the Jackalope, because the Jackalope evokes all of these topics, you know, just this bunny with antlers that we all think is cute. But there's so much stuff associated with it. All these things are like the Jackalope's antlers, you know, branching off in so many different directions.
Absolutely.
I think politically, the Pacific Northwest has been dominated by people who were standard West Coast, influenced by Hollywood, liberal Americans. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones that like shunned the city life, basically. But they did all those who like who built the political climate in the Pacific Northwest, I think, are people who came up from Southern California. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
But we're not talking about the Pacific Northwest here, but rather Wyoming.
Yeah.
Much different climate. So how much of this stuff, like just looking at the pictures of this little thing next to a bunch of cactuses and like in the desert, like I'm trying to think of other desert monsters and I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Like,
I mean, is there a desert in Wyoming?
No.
I don't know. There's not, right?
No.
That's the thing. So this originated in Wyoming, but as it spread through all the states, now everybody is appropriating it in their own different way and reinterpreting it.
And I have Google Image open on the side here, and I'll tell you, the first like 20 pictures are all this thing in a desert with a cactus. Uh-huh. Like almost all of it is that Southwest. Like, yeah, that's super interesting.
And it's also interesting, like there was something called the Cactus Cat. in Californian folklore. Yep. And it's also a fearsome critter. But now we can see the jackalope kind of taking over as an invasive imaginal species.
Ooh, there's a concept for you. That's awesome. I love it.
I like it.
What was the cactus cat?
The cactus cat was kind of a cat that was full of thorns.
Yeah.
And it would attack drunk people in the desert who were sleeping and bash them in the head or whatever with its tail that's full of thorns.
Yeah.
I was hoping it could shoot thorns like the cartoon porcupines that I always thought was a real thing. That's amazing. I have never heard of that one.
Yeah, the cactus cat is cool. It's just another one of those awesome little fearsome critters, right? There's so many cool little creations. Like they basically had their, lumberjacks basically had their own like Looney Tunes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's sort of how I think of fearsome critters.
Like with lumberjacks, are these all oral traditions that somebody else documented eventually, that style thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
There wasn't like a lumberjack note keeper that was writing all this stuff down while cutting down trees.
No, I don't think so. No, they mostly, they just had like oil pencils to keep count of how many trees came down that day. And that's about it. Vuk and I have talked about this before that like, and we've been talking about settling the West. The lumberjacks are like the unsung heroes of settling the West.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't think about them, but like they were out there on the edge of the edge, clearing land for people. Like before anyone was settling towns or anything, these like huge arboreal forests had to be taken out, you know?
Keepers of the borders.
There weren't just like beautiful valleys waiting for a town to be built on.
Yeah.
Wow.
And also I know that lumbering is the number one most deadliest occupation in America.
Yep. Still.
And still, and especially back then. So it is very interesting to me. You would first think, wow, what would a folklore of this occupation look like? And you'd think dark, brooding, edgy stuff.
Yeah, I know.
But yet again, it's, you know, tall tales and very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, they needed a break from the terror that they lived in all day long, you know? They needed Looney Tunes.
Yeah, even the like most popular, like the Babe the Big Blue Ox and stuff like that. It's just so silly and fun. And like, was the flannel thing, was that a lumberjack thing from the beginning? Like, is that just in my head as like a cartoon, or was that actually like what lumberjacks look like?
I think it's mostly a cartoon. I mean, that was once towns were settled, then those more intricate garments started popping up. You know, originally it was pretty basic stuff. Wool to keep yourself warm, and that's about it.
Lumberjack culture, fascinating. I want to know all about it now.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Vuk, can we just make this about lumberjack culture now?
I love where this episode is heading. Because, as I say, it's like the antlers of the jackalope. You start somewhere and then you go various different directions. Yep. That's what the jackalope conveys. And I'm thinking now, like, maybe it really is an invasive species that is completely fictional and manufactured. Because now nobody knows about the fearsome critters, but everybody knows what a jackalope is.
Yeah.
And yet it is not from the original, you know, pantheon of fearsome critters. It is something that was manufactured for economic purposes. Very, very American.
Yeah, very.
And then it spread. It dominated the industry of fearsome critters. And now it is the face of fearsome critters, yet it is not an original. It is just a manufactured derivative.
Yeah.
That's super interesting.
You were talking about the cactus cat and how it would attack drunk people. And that reminded me of one of my favorite parts of the jackalope lore, which is if you leave a bowl of whiskey out overnight, the jackalope will drink it. And then it gets drunk enough to believe that it can catch a bullet in its teeth.
Yes.
So, and that's the only way to actually kill a jackalope is to find one in that state.
Dude, that's amazing.
Yes. And also, like, usually they would leave whiskey for the jackalope so it can fall asleep, so they can milk the female jackalopes, because it was believed that jackalope milk is an aphrodisiac.
Yeah. And the jackalope, well drunk, would sleep on its back.
Yes.
Dude. Which would expose the little jackalope udders.
I love how there's like an element of hubris to that. Like, it's not like the jackalope just gets drunk and falls asleep and then you can, you know, dispose of it. It's like, no, it gets drunk and it thinks it's the shit and it's going to catch this bullet in its teeth.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That conveys my own interpretation, or rather why I love the jackalope, because it's an embodiment of the trickster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is the Bugs Bunny of the cryptid world.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, really that's perfect is. Too, because Bugs Bunny yes. also is a chimera, right? And a mm-hmm. chimera, right? Half yeah. bunny, half person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, the trickster is known as somebody who transgresses taboos and who constantly shifts. Sometimes, like, trickster figures in folklore can change their gender. Even Bugs Bunny changes yeah. his gender constantly, no. you know?
Spot yep. on. Yes. Spot on. Yeah, that's amazing.
It challenges what is acceptable or your framework of what you think of reality itself. It is also a figure that likes to get drunk and it likes to have sex. It's believed that jackalopes mate during thunder strikes.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I love that.
And you bring up hubris. That's also a very tricksterish thing, you know?
Totally. Yeah. And a big Bugs Bunny thing. Bugs Bunny as a trickster is got, someone's probably written a paper on it or something, because there's so many parallels. Like, just yeah. that, like, that playful deviance that Bugs Bunny represents. Like, he's kind of an asshole, but one that you love and that, like, you want on your team, you know? Which is mm-hmm. kind of yeah. a great way to picture the trickster. This all makes me think of, and the trickster stuff too, like, the idea of what kind of controls or spreads these myths. Like, is there something behind the fact that Fearsome Critters was left behind for Jackalope to spread further? Like, is there something behind in the more, like, bigger consciousness sense that, like, picks these stories that they know is going to spread the message that is at the core of it farther? Or is it just random? Yeah. Like, I don't know.
I think that it all falls back to archetypes. And I think a lot of the archetypes that the Fearsome Critters were built around are kind of outdated at this point. And that's yeah. why they haven't really held tight to, you know, to mainstream society. A lot of the things that were relevant in day-to-day life for people at the time, you know, are no longer at the forefront of people's minds. But the jackalope, all those archetypes, the trickster archetype is definitely yeah. alive and well. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. You could say that for sure. That's a great point. And like it makes a lot of sense those archetypes would fall away because we're not like, we don't have land to expand on like that. Like, we're not in this kind of like material expansion. We're way more in that imaginal expansion that, like, Vuk, you've referenced the antlers kind of represent. Like, it's mm-hmm. not, yeah, we've ran out of land, but we got plenty of mind space.
Oh, yeah. And isn't it ironic that this whole tree of antlers is sprouting from the head?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
And branching off. I also want to say that, like, I'm thinking why it's proliferated so much throughout every single state in the US. And the only reason we know about the jackalope is because all of us somewhere saw a taxidermy of a jackalope and yeah, thought, I want to know what that thing is. And then, oh, it's a jackalope. And that's how you know of it. So why it proliferated is because everybody is exposed to the image of a jackalope. Nobody is exposed to a squonk before we had, you know, social media now and all of you digital artists creating the squonk, you know, and yeah, spreading
absolutely.
It around. Yeah, but back then, like, if you want to convey, let's say, a bear cryptid and make it a thing that everybody's going to see, you need to kill a lot of bears to taxidermy them, you know?
Yeah,
but
totally.
But, you know, rabbits are notorious for mating all the time and just making their populations larger and larger, that now you need to hunt them down so they don't ruin the ecosystem.
Yeah, there's no tag limit for rabbits.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not to mention everyone who hunts, like, regularly, like someone you would call a hunter, they have antler sheds all over the place. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, they, and you find them in the wild, right?
Totally.
Like, I think there's something to that, because there's yeah. just the availability of the materials needed, right? It was just there.
Well, with invasive species in biology, it's like the species that is able to adapt to various different ecological niches. So it can utilize any kind of available resource. It needs to be very generic and all-encompassing. In the hunter world, there's nothing more all-encompassing than hunting down rabbits, and you already have a plethora of antlers at your
Absolutely.
Disposal. So you're utilizing something that you already have in plentiful amounts. And that's why the jackalope has become such a pop cultural icon and spread all over the place, because we are utilizing something that is more accessible.
Totally. And it looks realistic. Like it doesn't look like a jump. Like sometimes you can look at these photoshopped ones with deers with antlers and you're like, oh, that could be an animal, where like some of the more out there thing, like I think it does have something to do with how much we've all seen. I mean, deer and bunnies are probably the two most seen animals in the, like, in my suburban habitat here. So antlers and bunnies just go hand in hand. Like I can see that crossover easily taking hold. But it's also super interesting that like it kind of has the, it's like when you first see a unicorn, like it looks like something that could exist because you're like, I've seen a narwhal, I've seen a horse, why not? Like before you're, you know, really aware. And like if I showed my 5-year-old this, like half of these pictures that are like photoshopped, he'd be like, yeah, that's a thing that you can go see in a zoo probably.
Oh yeah, and a lot of Americans actually thought, before they found out that it's a mythological thing, they actually thought, oh, that's a very rare species of rabbit.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There's side note, my daughter, who's now 10, for years, it took us years to convince her that narwhals were a real thing.
That's amazing.
she thought that they were some fictional thing like a unicorn, and we could not convince her for years. Like,
and how ironic is that, because you right? know that their tusks were sold as unicorn horns. Even I think Queen Elizabeth I had a whole collection of them.
That's so funny. You know, that lines up with my kids too. I feel like certain, like they're more tied to reality in certain ways. We're like, no, that's bullshit.
Yeah. Just instantly skeptical.
Yeah, totally.
The exact opposite of when I was a kid, and I was like, you know, like you were just saying, the first time you see a unicorn, you're like, that could be real. That's how I was too. But she sees something that's actually real, and she's like, no way, that can't
Jordan,
be real.
I think there's something to that, man. Like you hear people talk a lot about how kids are becoming more empathetic at an earlier age, and like that side of emotional stuff. But I think the like skepticism or like the logic brain is almost more inherent to kids these days. For some reason, like I think, especially, I don't know, there's something to it.
I think it's because kids are from a very early age now bombarded with bullshit. Like,
yeah,
if you go on any website, you're gonna see pop-ups like, oh, you're the winner of the prize and whatnot.
Sure.
And kids are now growing up with that, so they at a very, very early age need to kind of learn how not to be duped.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I just didn't have to pick up the landline when I was little and no one, or answer the ringing doorbell or look at the mail, which was very easy to do to avoid sales. But that's a great point. Not a very positive one, I don't know.
I have one question. So like, fearsome critters are very tongue-in-cheek and silly, and they come from a population of the, you know, American community, which was going through hardship every single day. So why are we now imagining, let's say, monsters like the Dog Man, a vicious, bloodthirsty thing that's out to kill your whole family? Like, what kind of cultural shift has happened where we used to create cool, fun, tongue-in-cheek mythological figures, which are a part of American folklore, but now modern American folklore is more violent?
Mm-hmm. I definitely have an opinion here.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jordan.
I think that the exact... Okay, because we were talking about how those creatures created by lumberjacks were sort of a break from their day-to-day, right? And I think life has just gotten so much easier for people since then. I think we actually...
Desire.
Yes. We have like a desire for that danger, for that feeling that you get when you're in trouble. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think same with like the recreational outrage that you see everywhere. I think it's just a result of things being too easy all the time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I think people need conflict. They need fear, right?
Totally.
I mean, that's the advent of extreme sports in modern times, which were not a thing back then.
In horror films, right?
Yeah.
Totally. And it lines up. We talk a lot, or have talked a lot, about how like that same easing of life allows for more creative endeavors, allows for like a society to have artists and more thinkers and like push imaginal things. And I don't know if this is like biologically right, but that evolved side of us to like protect us from tigers and lions and all of that shit is still there. Like, we haven't lost that. So we have to hone it in some way, right? Like, and the imagination is the realm in which it's, I guess, better acted out in that realm than in, like, you know, real life or violent acts or I don't know. I guess
so
extreme sports.
Maybe there is some inherent fear offering that you need to provide. And if you're not providing it by actually interacting with death and misery in real life, you need to provide it imaginally or creatively.
Yeah, I think maybe that sounds really dark, but maybe it's more of just like a reverence for nature, for like how seriously it should be taken. You know what I mean?
And like, if you look at fear as kind of a logical extension of death, then it's really a reverence of death. Like if like the base fear that most people are, like, you know, taking home, or I guess anxiety might be a better word than fear, comes from that like ending of oneself, either physically or egoically or whatever you want to say, then like all of this can be, I think reverence is a great word, Jordan. I think that's a, you know, a more positive way to look at it for sure. But yeah, the whole fear being a part of this, I think, is also has to do with what we've talked about, that it's all, the point of this stuff is to make you, to break your normalcy. It's to flip your daily view on this stuff. And fear is sometimes just the quickest way to access that flip, maybe. Or, you know, like humor can do it. You can walk away from something that's like really funny and have that same kind of new look, but like fear seems to be a quicker access point for some reason.
Yeah, but then again, if you're saying like it needs to break your sense of normalcy, that's again the trickster aspect. Yeah, the trickster is there to insert novelty into a stagnating society, to rattle the cage a bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, that's very true. And I mean, it does, you know, when I think of trickster, I don't think of dark or evil or fear. I think way more playful, and like it utilizes all the darkness to, you know, express itself, but it's not like, it doesn't have a, you know, a good or evil to it. It's
it
kind
does
of,
not have a moral alignment. It's a true
that's
neutral.
It. Yeah. No. That's
but
the words
it,
I was looking
it
for.
It utilizes all the tools at its disposal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you should just speak for me.
That's what gives it, I mean, that's what makes a trickster, right? Is that it's unpredictable, right? That true neutral alignment, you don't ever know what to expect. And that's what keeps you guessing. And that's what allows it to keep injecting novelty, is that it's never what you're expecting. It's never what's already there. And as soon as you think it's going to be a change, maybe it isn't a change. And then once you get comfortable with it not being changed, then it gets changed, right?
I think that's
I really like the synchronistic aspect. So as we mentioned, the jackalope was invented in 1932. In 1933, Shoup published his paper on the discovery of the Shoup papillomavirus of cottontail, I think, rabbits, which is considered the natural inspiration behind the jackalope, because it's a disease that causes horny warts on the faces of rabbits. So rabbits can appear to have horns or like tusks protruding from their mouth and stuff like that. Oftentimes they die because they can't eat, because it completely closes off their mouth.
Now, like an important element of that too is that papillomavirus actually led to the discovery that some cancers can be caused by viruses.
Yes.
That was not something people believed before this. So the reason that we understand like the human papillomavirus, HPV, and the fact that it causes cervical cancer comes from this discovery. Like,
wow.
It was a huge moment. The people who actually like, because he kind of laid the groundwork, the people who took it a step farther and actually connected it to the human papillomavirus actually won the Nobel Prize for that discovery. Yes. Like, it's a massive moment in medical history.
I also want to point out, I don't know how associated it is, but like all this goes into different directions. The HPV virus can cause like keratinous growths on, you know, our sex organs. Mostly in women, it causes cervical cancer, but it can cause, you know, these growths in female anatomy. And that could have been the inspiration for the folkloric motif of the vagina dentata, the toothed vagina.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I did not see us going there. That's, that's wild.
So again, you know, Shoup papillomavirus has folkloric ties to bunnies, but then the human papillomavirus also has folkloric ties to something else.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't even know where to go from there, Vuk.
Actually, I am in that mind space because recently somebody published a book on the vagina dentata. So I'm thinking, wow, I should reach out to that person to have them on the show. That's such a cool topic.
Yeah. I mean, it's just another one of the antlers on the jackalope, right? It's just like another weird connection, another strange synchronicity.
Yes.
Like,
Yes. Yeah. But I'm also thinking, like, did the Jackalope inspire Shope to look into this? Like, his paper was published in 33. Of course, he's gonna be spending a year at least doing all these tests and experiments. So if this came out in 32, did he maybe become aware that, hey, these brothers are selling antlered bunnies? Because from what I read, Shope was informed by some hunters that they have caught rabbits with horns on their heads. And he was interested to find out what the heck is happening, and told them to send him, you know, specimens if they caught them. And they did. And that's how he discovered this disease.
Yeah, because he was actually famous for studying animal to human transmission.
Yes, so his most famous discovery is swine flu.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. He connected the pandemic of like 1918, I think. He connected that back to swine flu.
Interesting. And interesting how I say that the jackalope is an invasive imaginal species because it has spread throughout the world as a virus.
Yeah.
And just as the thing that inspired it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just sitting back kind of thinking about everything that we've talked about. And I love these subjects that people are so used to just seeing the surface of, right? Like the jackalope you see everywhere all the time. And people don't realize the depth of history behind these like tiny little cute creatures that you see drawn on sweatshirts and, you know, keychains. But there's this like rich piece of humanity behind it. And yeah, that's why I love talking to you guys, because every time we do it, we end up like diving into this chunk of history that no one ever even thinks about.
Oh yeah.
No, I think that's like the best part of this stuff, is accessing all of the side quests that like really are like almost every, like whether it's Mothman or any of the big ones, like the thing itself is never really the interesting part. It's all the stuff around the thing in which is interesting. So the jackalope is just like none of the main thing and just all the side stories apparently. Like I didn't know any of this pretty much coming into here. Like I didn't read Wikipedia. Vuk told me not to read anything and I didn't read anything. So
awesome.
Like the fact that I just learned about how we discovered HPV and like how the West was won, like that's fucking crazy. Yeah. That was not expected for this afternoon chat about a bunny with antlers.
Oh yeah. And the problem is like most often, like people will see jackalope in the title of my episode and think, oh, we're going into some fun superficial stuff, because people usually go into these mythological creatures just focusing on the creature and whether it's real or not. But that's totally the most surface level bullshit that somebody, you know, can get into. But it's the hooking point, you know. Now we have the symbol of the jackalope all over the world, and somewhere somebody is also having this discussion like we are, just because they saw that image somewhere. It's like it's an embodiment of so many different ideas, of so much culture and history that you cannot convey in words unless you want to write a whole tome. So you create a character to convey all of this.
Absolutely.
Before we wrap, before we get anywhere near that, I wanted to include the first time I ever saw a jackalope was my older brother went on vacation to Hawaii. And this like falls perfectly in line with the idea of it as a invasive species, right?
Exactly.
He went to Hawaii and he brought me back. I was probably, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. He brought me back a sweatshirt that said Aloha from Hawaii. And it was a picture of a jackalope surfing.
Amazing.
Yeah. Like, how removed from Wyoming is that?
Yeah, that's just too good.
And how fucked up is that, man? Yeah. Because so much of the indigenous species have been wiped off of Hawaii with, you know, colonization. And now you're colonizing it with your culture. I talk with Jeremy Vinny about this often and hear him talk about it because he is in Hawaii. He says how Hawaii has a completely different, you know, folklore and feel and kind of mythology of the land. Like, he does not experience alien abduction stuff there, but he does experience, let's say, like, you can't say out loud something over there if you don't mean it, because it's, I don't know, a belief or a phenomenon there that these synchronistic things will kind of happen, so you need to be careful what you wish for. And he also recently talked about a cougar that ended up there. They had a huge problem with a cougar.
Wow.
Yeah, it's probably some rich asshole wanted a cougar there and just, you know, lost it.
Yeah.
So some rich asshole took the jackalope there, and now it's spread spreading and yep. taking over the local mythology.
Yeah, it's that was my first exposure to the jackalope. Was it surfing? So
that's amazing.
It was quite a while before I saw it, you know, in its original state.
But it's interesting then how this thing is so malleable that throughout history and it's spreading all over the place, everybody is kind of interpreting it. It's their own different way, and it's essentially folklore in the making because it is very modern, recent folklore.
Yeah. I was just thinking pretty much this whole time, like, have I ever drawn a jackalope? And I don't think I have. And I think the reason is because when I'm looking at drawing things, like, my general MO is to take something and make it a little cuter and simpler and just, like, you know, give it big old doughy eye. And, like, that's, I don't know if I can progress the cuteness of this thing at all. Like, I feel like that's been done already. Like, just looking at these pictures, I'm like, oh yeah, that's how I would do it. That's better than I would do it.
Are you also intimidated knowing that you will start from something very cute, very simple, and the more you go upwards, the more complex it will become because of the antlers?
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. I don't do very much antler stuff, I guess. That's uh-huh. funny.
But that's how the jackalope conveys this. Like, everybody goes yeah. into the jackalope expecting something very simple, very familiar, and the uh-huh. more you go up, the more it branches off and becomes so absolutely. Intricate and complex.
No, that's a beautiful interpretation of it. And I think it's, yeah, there's something there for sure. I think I'm going to have to try and draw a jackalope sometime soon now.
Yeah. I can imagine it just as a jackalope head or like a whole jackalope, but its antlers, like, the more they go upwards, the more they just entangle in various different ways.
Totally. How many, like, antlered critters are out there? Like, how many folkloric things have antlers? A ton, right?
I mean, apart from the Wendigo, and the Wendigo does not have antlers. It's just a white man's appropriation of it.
So is it not? Is it just like?
I don't think so.
Is it just in my brain from I don't even know what? Like, for some reason, I can picture lots of things with antlers, but I can't. I'm with you. I can't think of any in particular. But it seems like something
I can't either.
That would be used yeah. a lot more. You know, like, it seems.
But
like
it is used in modern fantasy fiction. Like, play any video game, you're gonna have monsters with antlers, and you're gonna have helmets that have antlers for your
yeah.
character.
Oh yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
It conveys this sense of grandiosity. I mean, mm-hmm. just with the jackalope, like, the jackalope is a bunny. It's a cute little creature, harmless. But because of the antlers, it conveys this idea, like, I should not disturb that thing because it's going to fuck me up. Even maybe if it's not going to fuck you up, just the antlers on its head convey this grandiosity, convey yeah. the message that there is more to it.
Totally.
Yeah, an intricacy. Yeah.
That's super interesting. I'd be interested to know, like, how, because I know antlers are used in a lot of different symbology and things, but yeah, just what their general mythology behind them is. It seems like there's a lot there for some reason.
I think so. I am a fan of Pokemon, and okay. a few generations ago there was this Pokemon Xerneas, which is essentially a deer with antlers that radiate different colors of the light. But it is, the shape of this Pokemon is essentially like the Tree of Life from Norse mythology.
Whoa, that's cool.
Yeah. So yeah. there is this tie between antlers and trees, and especially the Tree of Life, or the Tree of the various, I think, nine realms in Norse mythology.
That's huge. It makes a lot of sense.
Okay, guys, this was very interesting. I'm going to keep it short because I need to edit this.
Yeah, you have a lot of corgi to edit.
Oh, I'm not going to edit the corgi.
Well, then apologies to the listener.
Yeah.
Jordan, can you imagine if your dog had antlers on his head, like your giant dog back there? Would you allow that in your house?
No,
I know. Like, how horrifying. I was just watching you wrestle with her for a minute, and I'm like, oh, yeah, no, you can't do that with that in antlers.
Yeah. But you know what people do for Christmas time? They put those fake moose antlers on
it's
their
true.
Dogs.
The reindeer antlers. She also,
that would be very appropriate.
The Irish Wolfhound is the Guinness spot for the longest tail.
Oh,
her
really?
Tail is insane, dude. It's like a, I mean, look at it. It's like a whip.
Yeah, it just knocks everything over, I'd imagine.
Also, she's only 5 months old.
Oh, that's a puppy.
Yeah. And you don't realize how annoying puppies are until they weigh 85 pounds.
Oh, yeah. That's a big puppy.
That's a lot. Anyway.
So for the end, Jordan, can you tell the listeners where they can find you?
Absolutely. You can find Campfire Tales of the Strange and Unsettling on Instagram or Facebook at campfire.tales.podcast. You can find us on TikTok at campfire.podcast. Twitter, campfire, T-O-T-S-A-U. Worst URL
Are you going to give your Patreon link? Because that's the most elaborate one.
Patreon.com/campfire tales of the strange and unsettling. And like I always say, it'll take you longer to type in the URL than it will to choose the tier. but you can do it. I believe in you.
Also, you are a writer for Paranormality, and now I am expecting you to write on the Jackalope.
Yeah, I'd love to. I would love to. And you can go to paranormalitymag.com to see any of the articles I've written for them.
Oh, yeah. And Todd, can you share your stuff?
Yeah. So you can check out my podcast, Create Magic Podcast, and I guess createmagicstudios.com. That's got links for everything. Patreon, shop, podcast, all that stuff. And then Instagram is the best place as far as social stuffs. And that's at Todd, T-O-D-D-D-E-8-5.
Okay, man. I'm probably going to be using Christina's artwork for this episode because she has portrayed the Jackalope quite a number of times.
Absolutely.
So bummed that she didn't make it.
Yeah, she did not make it, but for the listeners, if you're interested in Christina's artwork, the links will be in my episode description. And on Instagram, she is the Crescent Hair. Hair as in the rabbit, the same rabbit as in the Jackalope.
That's right.
Thank you guys for joining me today. I am going to release this probably much sooner than you, Jordan, released our other roundtable.
Yeah, it might end up being the same week. That'd be fun.
Oh, that'd be funny.
Yeah. So until next time, guys, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, listeners, so we're now back because we got another cool idea to share here. And I don't know how I'm going to manage editing all of these segments. So go ahead.
Okay, so I brought up that I used to play a game called Hunter Call of the Wild. I was once hunting rabbits on the game, and I was just sort of sat in a bush using the rabbit call, and suddenly a rabbit blazes through the screen, like faster than the rabbits usually move in the game. And I was convinced, 100% convinced, that it had antlers. Now, I spent hours after this Googling, searching, reading like message boards for the game and all that, and couldn't find a single mention of a jackalope being part of the game.
Yes.
So I think I may have had a jackalope sighting.
Exactly. That's why I wanted to record this, because the way you are telling this story, it's like the way somebody who saw a cryptid in the wild would be telling. So are we actually able to now have cryptid encounters and experiences via video games?
Yeah, that's awesome. I think also the idea that so much of this is so much of the phenomenon is created from the experiencer, right? Is like, does it really matter if it's a virtual medium or not? Like,
no.
When, you know, 50 years from now, when we're all using, you know, virtual reality and it's basically indistinguishable from life, are people going to be having cryptid sightings in VR, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Or like Vooks mentioned before, as far as VR being used as, or I think you may have said it via AI, but VR being the same use as far as psychedelics or having psychedelic experiences and like being used that way, it doesn't make that psychedelic experience any less valid, you know, whether it's from a entheogen or a piece of technology.
But you know what's interesting to me? What Jordan said, he is not certain if this rabbit he saw on the screen of the video game had antlers or not, but yet he still felt it as a cryptid experience, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe the jackalope is not even a part of the programming of the game. Maybe it's just a glitch that some weird ass shaped glitchy rabbit went, you know, very fast through the screen. But then you interpret that as a jackalope or a cryptid, and that influences you, and then you have a story to tell.
Yeah, I don't have any other stories about rabbit hunting in that game. So clearly it was different, you know,
to me.
There was something. That's very interesting.
And now, I mean, that could have been a very bland game that if that did not happen to you, you would never even even think of that game ever again in your life.
Sure.
But now that it happened, that game is imprinted into you.
Yep. Huh. It's definitely true.
Wow. So we can, okay. Oh man, this goes back full circle. This thing, the Jackalope, started as a marketing ploy. Can we actually utilize paranormality as a marketing ploy? Can somebody intentionally program, let's say, into video games, cryptid experiences, and make a shitty game, but because of those experiences, people will be remembering the game?
Yeah. I mean, you really could do that. Yeah. And not talk about that it's there, just let people have the experience and talk about it themselves.
Oh yeah.
Totally. And I feel like video games are uniquely, like, I don't play any video games, to be honest with you. I was never a video game kid growing up, and just it never clicked with me, but it makes so much sense because you're so you are such a big part of the story. Like, you are literally putting yourself first person in most of these things. And like, I mean, yeah, it makes so much sense that that would be, you're going to be able to have some different experiences than just reading a book or doing things that are so just consumption based.
It's very interesting to me that in the 30s, these two brothers very unintentionally utilized paranormality for marketing and for an economic benefit. And now we live in the age of corporations. And maybe once paranormality becomes a more mainstream thing, and once we realize what kind of effect it has on people psychologically, we are going to start utilizing paranormality in the corporate world.
I think it's already started, Vuk. I listened to a professor actually from the University of Delaware, which I thought was really cool talk. And her whole thing is about paradoxical thinking. And she works for Fortune 500 giant companies and teaching them how to think better paradoxically. And what is a better execution of paradoxical thinking than the paranormal? Like, holding that duality of these things being physical and spiritual at the same time. And with, I think Eric Davis coined the term of global weirdening, and how weird everything's getting. Like, viewing the world in these paradoxical senses is going to become more of a skill that we all have to adapt to. Like, it's just something that's going to be necessary if things keep going in this kind of novelty ramp up stage that it seems to be.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So yeah, people are paying lots of money to be taught how to think weird right now.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Because totally. Adapting to what's going on now is, it's going to become a more and more premium ability.
Yeah. No, literally, this professor was talking about it, like, having giant corporations bring her in to be like, listen, there's no good or bad. Your company is not good or bad. It's not successful or unsuccessful. There's no this or that. It's everything in between. It's like, and like, listening to her talk about that stuff applied to corporate things made me like really excited and kind of disgusted at the same time. And like, you know, one of those things where I'm like, all these beautiful thoughts that I like love and kind of hold as like these creative inspirationals are now just, it makes sense that the, you know, in our culture, the end of that is somebody figuring out how to economically benefit from those things.
But I mean, the corporate world is a condensed society.
Yes, that's
true. It's a condensed reflection of society. So once paranormal thinking becomes a more mainstream thing, you will start kind of privatizing it and incorporating it into the economy.
That makes all the sense in the world. Totally. I think it's overall just kind of, you know, it's funny that we landed on that via the Jackalope again. That's a very appropriate way to, you know, jump back into this.
Oh, yeah. Jumping, huh? I'm going to end this now. And listeners, bye-bye. I hope this is the last rabbit hole we jump into.